everybody to the January 2019 Disabilities Advisory Board meeting. And we're going to get it started like we always do with community input. So if you'd like to say a few things or share some insights or those kinds of things, please raise your hand. Oh, I forgot. I was supposed to introduce our newest member of the board, which is Rika Strong. She's with the
Educational Opportunities for Children and Families. It's an early learning program in Southwest Washington.
Great, thank you.
Yeah, and she was Ronnie's boss, those of you that remember Ronnie.
We go to the boss. Share bad stories about me.
Before we get started, are there agendas floating around somewhere?
I sent them that way.
So real happy to have Rika here. Again, always in connection with the children and concept of transition has always been really important to us. Okay. So if I can have anybody that's willing to share anything, does anybody have something for us to hear? Yes, please, Dara.
I just wanted to make sure everybody was aware that next week is our legislative reception, and I have invitations. And Advocacy Day starts on January 30th, I believe. And so I have flyers for everyone. And we will be taking carloads up from here. We would love for people to sign up and come up with us. It's an excellent opportunity for us to advocate for our loved ones with intellectual and developmental disabilities.
Great. Thank you.
And this is the first year that we haven't really gotten the word as early. So, for whatever reason.
And we have some legislators in some pretty key positions as well. So it's important that they hear from their local community.
Okay. Who are some of those individuals?
Senator Annette Cleveland is the chair of the Health Care Committee, which is where all DE legislation goes through. And Senator Linda Wilson is on the JLARC committee, and they're hearing a lot of issues right now. They'll be coming out with some studies and some responses next week on employment, some different things like that. So, and Senator Ann Rivers is actually the what's the term, Adrian? She's Ann's co-chair of the Not in Leadership Party.
Kiggins. We kind of didn't get that kicked off the ground or scheduled yet, but if we need folks to see it, preview it, to decide whether or not to sponsor one locally, the Northwest Down Syndrome Association is sponsoring a screening on the 29th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Northwest Down Syndrome Association location, which is Northeast Portland. So I think it's an amazing film, and I would love to have, and Bethesda would love to participate in sponsoring a local screening at the Kiggins, and I did do some cursory discussion with them about hosting perhaps a series of some of these films that are out now focusing on people with intellectual developmental disabilities, and Kiggins is willing. They just need like to think through when the timing and a series of screenings, so maybe we can have like a film month highlighting one per week or something at the Kiggins around some of these great new films that are coming out around young adults with developmental disabilities, and the Intelligent Lives one really walks through that transition into adulthood and adulthood and employment. I think it would spark some really great conversations, and I would love to perhaps facilitate some after screening conversations. I think that would just be a really cool thing to do. So if we need to have a little more momentum behind that idea by people actually seeing some of the films locally and saying, oh yeah, maybe we should do it here in Vancouver. I would be happy to help, like, facilitate that. I just think it's going to be a cool
thing. It's not a new film, but have you ever seen The Eighth Bit?
Yeah. And we do
this. Do they have it dubbed, or do they have it in the subtitle in English?
Yeah. There's some really good ones, and if you may recall, maybe not, this was years ago, so Ben is aged out of the programs now, but when he was 8 and 9, we had screenings of, including Samuel, which was one of Dan Habib's first documentaries around including a child with in a wheelchair with significant CP in a regular classroom. And we had screenings. We actually shared that around the Vancouver School District staff at that time. It was shared within special ed and regular ed. And there was a lot of momentum around thinking through and doing better at inclusion because we sponsored that film. And so I think it might be time for some of that kind of stuff. And I would just like to lift that up to the board as an idea to consider. Maybe in March for Disability Awareness Month, or April for Autism Awareness Month, or but if we want to schedule things, because we need to kind of get started on getting that on the calendar.
How long are the films?
They're typical, like 50 to 90 minutes.
Okay.
They're not 2-hour movies. Uh-huh. They're documentaries, and so but I think there's one that's about 45 to about 90 is probably the longest.
Okay.
And several of these films, like including Samuel, come with discussion guides. Mm-hmm. Like you could pay a small licensing fee for a discussion guide and have a question and answer period and discussion guide with the community members that show up around our own community and what they think. I think it might be a real interesting way to get some vision or some ideas around what the local community would like to see, using that as a catalyst for conversation. So,
Trudy and Dr. Melnick in the health department have done some research, both of them on different times, mm-hmm. on films. If you, I mean, we can be a repository also of different films.
I think that would be cool.
Because she was even talking to the people that made the film.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Trudy just goes in there and...
The filmmakers.
Yeah. Yeah. Autism and Love is the one she was, we were talking about.
There were a number of them. So in December, TASH, the National TASH Conference, was in Portland, and they screened a number of films there, some of which were made by filmmakers with intellectual developmental disabilities. And I would just like to, lift that up as a way to maybe jumpstart some conversations at the community level in a different way.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Other folks have any other questions? Maybe that's something we can discuss further later on in the agenda as a possible sponsorship. That's the first thing I thought of. In cooperation with the school districts, the special ed school districts, so that we get a ready-made audience, nothing like seating the auditorium. And also at the same time, kind of work on our continued efforts to inform the people of Clark County. Any other comments? Okay.
I would also include businesses.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. And would there be a red carpet where everybody be photographed as
they come in? Yeah, you know, many of these films, like Intelligence Lives, they're not charging anything. You set up the event, they give you the, I mean, they don't charge anything for the film.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like it's a costly event. And Kiggins mm-hmm. is real willing to, like, adjust things when it's community-based and community mm-hmm. engagement and enhancement kinds of things. Mm-hmm. So it wouldn't be a costly event. It would just need some PR. And yeah. You guys have better access to that than some of us others do. Well,
Darla has the biggest mailing list.
But people already engaged with the disability community. I think it would be great to include others, you know, from the Port Project and from the colleges and, you know, some of those kinds of things.
Great. Okay. Well, let's discuss it further to see if the... the rest of the board wants to take on a task like that. So, you know, Any other public input? You sure? Just a chance of a lifetime. Okay. Well, I'd like to introduce right now Tanya May, the Director of Special Education with the Office of the Superintendent of Public Education. And she's going to be doing a presentation for us right now, I'm assuming with the PowerPoint.
Yes, I have.
Okay. So we'll need to slide over so that we're not blinded.
Right. Mm, and I don't know what I just did.
Sorry.
Oh. I don't know
what I'm
sponsored by
Dell. Now you're going to follow the Dell.
There are
children.
Here are some handouts that she's put together.
Yeah, thank you, Mary, for Mary ran those off. I wasn't sure whether everyone would be able to see the screen. So we do have some handouts as well. Good evening, my name is Tanya May, and as Mary said, I'm the Director of Special Education at the Office of Superintendent of Public Instruction, or OSPI. And I have been in this role just about a year. I've been in Washington since 2014. I've been a special educator for many decades, and I have a 10-year-old who is on the spectrum. So kind of wear both of those hats as I do this job. So we can go on. So the first slide is just our more recent vision, mission, and values that were developed when Superintendent Reichdahl, I apologize. Sorry about that.
Well, it was time to present.
It was, I'm done, yeah. That was short and sweet. that was on seconds. I probably need a little bit more time than that. So the next slide, I really wanted to call out. So if we advance one more slide. So it's a little hard to see the color on the screen, but the bottom bullet is what I wanted to really call out. So this is an equity statement that was drafted in concert with a variety of stakeholders. So educators, leaders, community leaders, parents, and students. And so the part that really stands out to me is what we're asking education leaders to do is to commit to actively dismantling systemic barriers and replacing them with policies and practices that ensure all students have access to instruction and the supports they need to succeed. So it's pretty powerful for me. We don't always see that kind of bald statement from our education leaders. So what I'm going to talk about today is I'm going to use a systemic framework from Simon Sinek called Starting With Why. And I don't know if people are familiar with his work, but I did include some links. So talk a little bit about, very briefly, research and data. But more of the time that I'm going to be spending on is how we're trying to approach this work around mindset, changing and confronting mindsets that people may have around this community. What some of the changes have been in terms of regulations with the Every Student Succeeds Act and how that impacts our community. And then our priorities that we're committing to just support students. And then finally, to talk a little bit about some of the policy. As we get toward the legislative session, we have proposed a new funding model for special education, so I'm going to talk a little bit about that and what that would mean for schools. And then some of the work that has been happening through what we've been calling the Transition Proviso Work Group. I've been working with Developmental Disabilities Administration staff, with the Division of Voc Rehab staff, and getting out into the community to talk about this work group. So that's also part of what we're going to do today. So this is the Golden Circle. And Simon Sinek talks, his TED Talk is linked right there if you haven't seen it. It's really good and very short. And he talks about how, especially in education, we tend to start with what are we going to do? What do we have to do? Let's do it. Let's move forward. And he kind of flips that and says, we need to start with the center. We need to start with why. Why is this an important thing to talk about, to do? And then start moving out to process and how. And then finally, the what. So just the framework for our talk today. So starting with why.
Keep going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the first one is a little bit of data. I don't know whether it's easier to see on your sheet or here, but I did a side by side. So this is these are the various categories of eligibility for special education in school. It's a little bit different than in the adult community. So we have 14 categories.
Is that better?
Is that better? Great. We have 14 categories of eligibility. And far and away, our largest categories are specific learning disabilities, health impairments, which include often attention deficit disorder, or attention deficit or hyperactivity disorder, and then communication disorder. But what I highlighted in red are the three categories that we would expect would be connected to the developmental disability community. So, and specifically looking at transition age, as students are getting ready to start moving on onto their next stage in life. So the categories that I highlighted, so for students who are ages 15 to 21, 11.6 of that group are eligible under autism. 6.7% are eligible under an intellectual disability, and then 4% for multiple disabilities. And so out of the 34,000 students last year that were 15 to 21, about 7,000 of those total would be students that we would expect would eventually move into the system and receive services from DDA. About 900 a year are the levers that we're thinking about. So I just want to pause there, because when we start talking about numbers, I know that can get a little bit confusing. Does anyone have a question for me about this?
Is there a further breakdown as far as geographically? Is there more of these circumstances in urban environments versus rural environments or suburban environments?
Yeah, so we did do some regional data. We don't in education break things down by county, which is different, and it, in working with my colleagues in DDA, that can be challenging sometimes because county is kind of how all of that is driven. Schools are either a school district or an educational service district, which is, there's nine of them in the state, and they're much larger, and they cross counties sometimes.
We have five counties.
So we do have some of that data that we've broken down. A little bit, but I would say that for the most part, it's pretty static. Any other questions? Okay, so we can go to the next slide. So as I have been going around and talking, having this kind of conversation, most of the time I am talking with school leaders, so superintendents, directors, principals. That's generally the audience that I'm able to reach. And I try to start with the research. So these are studies that have date back all the way back to 1932. So these are meta-analyses that were run. So from 1932 to 1970, 75 to 84, 80 to 2013, and then a very, very recent study that's specific to our state in Washington. And every single one of those studies has shown that barring, controlling for everything else, controlling for type of disability, controlling for type of instruction, the more access that students have to general education, the greater the outcomes. And so again, I've hyperlinked those, so Mary has the electronic version if anyone wanted to take a look at some of those. There are links. So this one we'll kind of click through one at a time. So the first couple of bullet points that I have been talking with the field about is, as we saw on the data slide, so less than 4% of our students, and I'm talking about 3 to 21, so our entire population of students in school with disabilities, less than 4% of them are identified as having an intellectual disability. Based on how we are finding students eligible, we're talking about close to 90% of those students across the state present with average to above average intellectual functioning. And if we go to the next bullet, however, statewide, only 56% of our students are in gen ed for the majority of the day. And when we talk about students of color, again, no different categories, that number falls to 47%. So I bring that up to this group because even with our students who would be expected to be able to access grade level content, even those students are not accessing gen ed. And so in our state, we are very, very far behind in terms of inclusive practices. And then click one more time. The other data point that we've been looking at is in our state, we have one diploma. We don't have an alternate diploma. Everyone gets the same diploma. Yes.
Can you tell by district the percent that are in?
Yes.
Again?
Yes.
Do you share?
Yes. It's all public, yes. And I put the link there. I'm trying to, as much as possible, give people access to these resources if they want to dig more. Also happy to have an individual conversation with anyone if you have some questions about it. So we have one diploma, but we have multiple pathways. And so what we're finding is that for our students with disabilities, the majority of them are accessing a pathway only available to students with disabilities. So all students can earn what's called a certificate of academic achievement. All students, that's the pathway that's open to everyone. A certificate of individual achievement is open only to students with disabilities and was originally intended really for our students who are taking the alternate assessment. But that has crept, and so you can see if we look at that CIA number, for English, 48.9%, and for math, 52%. We have some districts, Mary asked a really good question about if we could disaggregate it. We have more than a few districts where 100% of the students are earning a CIA. Statistically, that doesn't make any sense for what we know about how disability exists in the community. And so this slide, thinking about the previous one, is probably not surprising. We find very, very, very large gaps in achievement. They don't have access to the education that the rest of the community has, and so they don't seek happy outcomes. So the top dotted line, they're just snapshots of the English language arts assessment results and math assessment results for the most current year. And the gap, the lower line, are students with disabilities. Keeping in mind, this doesn't even include our students on the alternate assessment because they're not measured in this. They're considered proficient. Okay. So final data point, final data slide to share are our outcomes. And so what I really wanted to call your attention to is the bottom bar graph. So 1 year after a student leaves, if they have an IEP at the time they leave the school system, we are required to complete a survey with them. So usually it's via phone. So call them up, usually it's their case manager. But different systems have different practices. And we find out what's their level of engagement. Are they in school or some kind of training? Are they working or volunteering? Do they have some kind of employment? Or are they not engaged, which is that bottom one. And so this is the 15-16 data. We are just now getting the 16-17, but I can tell you that that bottom has not changed at all. It is exactly the same, 27.8% are not engaged. And what I have, again, been talking about with the communities as I go around the state is, imagine if we had an unemployment rate of 27.8, how our system would be responding to that. And yet, for this population, it's considered acceptable.
Who's that said that?
The system has said that.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, good question.
Have we looked at why these numbers are what they are? My point is the no engagement sometimes is the result of, okay, they're through the educational system, now they're warehoused or they're sheltered or whatever it may be, or marginalized, And in part, that's because of not only the society, but also their parents and the thinking of protecting and being overly cautious. Do we know any reasons why the no engagement?
Sure, we do. We do. It's not publicly put out because it's student-level data, but absolutely we could look at just some trends. There are multiple questions. It takes quite a while to get through the survey, and it does ask them those types of things.
There are a lot of people like myself, for example. He does a lot of volunteering, but he's not employed.
Depending on how, right, like they would try to tease that out, it could go under the other employment. Or under training.
In something.
They really do try to note whatever they can. So that is usually that they really are at home.
Any questions?
So this data from 2015, so the number of students that graduated, say, was 5,000. What percentage of students were we able to account for in this post-outcome process?
Yeah, great question. We have a pretty high response rate. It stayed up around 72-73% of all leavers.
Mm-hmm. And this is information that's gathered by the high school case manager then, or the state?
It is at the district level. So it could be the teacher. Sometimes it's like central office staff. It depends on the school system. But most of the time, the teacher.
Thank you.
Yeah.
The teacher makes the call to the family and your child.
Most of the time. Yes.
Or to the individual. So if the individual's self-reporting, how the individual reports may or may not be accurate. Because some of us have never gotten those calls as parents.
Okay, so I'm going to keep this going. So then moving into the how. I'm going to go very briefly through this. This is just so that you so we have a framing for this process, so you can keep going. So this goes kind of to Mary's point. So one of my favorite quotes is, every system is perfectly designed to get the results it gets. So if we don't like the results we're getting, fair enough, then we need to look at how we're going to make systemic changes in order to change that. So that's kind of where our efforts have been going. So we can keep going. Every Student Succeeds Act, that is our new federal education law. So that's for all students. And the stated purpose of this new law is to close the achievement gaps and to offer opportunity and fair education to all students. And so that is an alignment of purpose with the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, which hasn't changed, right? We're still operating under that same federal law. And that's about ensuring access and progress in the general education curriculum. I think sometimes we forget that. And these are our priorities, so they're on your sheet. We are working on all six of these priorities simultaneously as we try to support students and families and educators. So leadership, growth mindset, evidence-based practices around instruction and supporting students, professional development for both special educators and special educators, resource allocation, I'm going to talk more about that, and then recruitment and retention of teachers. I don't think it will be a surprise to this field that we have an incredibly difficult time keeping special educators in the field. So now our what? What are we going to do? So the first one is, this was a recommendation that came out of a work group that was brought together by the state legislature. They asked a group to come together and relook at safety net. Is anyone in here familiar with safety net? Okay. So safety net is a provision in our state when a student with a disability has a program that is very costly and would exceed the amount of money that the state would be getting for that student, for the special education services, the district can request reimbursement for that extra cost, the high cost. So it's been in our state for many years. It is an incredibly difficult process for school districts. The state legislature wrote that in order to receive this money, the safety net money, the IEP has to be properly formulated. Well, I don't know about you guys, but it is pretty hard to not find an IEP that has something wrong with it. So there are a lot of times districts can't recoup that money because there's an error in the IEP. So they came together, they made some recommendations. Part of what they were asked to do is to relook at how we fund special education. And they came up with a pretty revolutionary proposal. They had proposed that the money that gets generated for a student, so a student with an IEP would be an individual individual funding model, would the multiplier, so the amount of money that we're going to multiply it by, changes the more services are provided in a general education setting. So the higher level of service, you see those weekly hours? The greater amount of service a student needs, and the more amount of time that those services are provided in general education, the more money that a district generates in order to support that program. It's to incentivize providing access to general education. And so it's not so much, don't worry if the numbers themselves don't make sense. The main thing to know is that the more time a student is spending in general education to receive their services, the more that it gets generated for the school district.
And this is a legislative concept you have this year?
Yes, this is it's in the governor's budget. He accepted
it. It's in the governor's budget. But this has not been started yet.
No, it's a proposal. Yeah, proposed. But, you know, first we needed to make sure that Superintendent Reichdahl would accept it, and he did. And next, we needed to make sure that the governor would go along with it, and he did. So pretty huge. I've only found one other, I've been doing tons of research on this. One other state did try this, New York State, but only in like 1989 to 90. I haven't found any other evidence that a system has tried to incentivize access to gen.
Why did New York stop it?
I don't know. I need to reach out to their leadership and find out. It's been a while. But their current funding model does not include it. So this was the transition requirement. So I'm just going to wrap by letting you know that I'm working with DVR and DDA on gathering input around how to support students and families and educators with that process of transition from school to post-school life. And so that's what we were asked to do, to come together and think about some plan, what are we going to work on? So the next couple of slides, these are just the members. I'm one of the members of the work group, and so I wanted you to have those names. And then what we've been working on is having a commitment to improve secondary transition outcomes, which was lowering that non-engagement rate that I showed you, making sure that whatever materials we share are easily understandable, and then communicating as much as possible with stakeholders, which is, again, one of the reasons I'm so happy to be here today. So we are, all of the work group members are going out and doing our best to make sure that people are aware of this project. And so what we're doing, we've been gathering resources. Many of you have already shared with us resources. We've gotten just an amazing wealth of information. And what we're trying to do is develop some kind of navigation tool for both families and staff to help bridge that transition. Because we've got three agencies with very different regulations, very different funding models, very different requirements. And we just don't want people to have a gap in service. Okay, next. So we did a statewide survey, an online survey, and we had over 700 responses, which is pretty great for a survey. Majority of the respondents, excuse me, were family members or parents. Next slide. And so this is what we found. We asked first, the first question, we had three. The first question was, what are the skills that students need that will support them in transitioning from school to post-school? And so the top three that came up were pre-employment training and skills, job exploration, job shadowing, competitive employment type training, and the third were self-advocacy skills for students so that they can communicate what they need. Go ahead.
If this is an online survey, what about the students who don't have a computer at home or the communities of color where there might be additional?
So we created in the survey a link that could be downloaded, and we also went out and talked with Paid. We talked with Open Doors for Multicultural Families. So we have a whole list of stakeholders and did what we could, you know, to try to get the word out to the communities and so that they could support people.
Has she broadened beyond King County?
King and Pierce mostly. Pierce, yeah. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to take up too much of your time, but the next one is what were the resources, like systems resources, that would support students? And the top, there were top four. So alignment of transition planning documents between school and post-school, so that someone could have a portfolio that they could just handle. Agency staff, so having knowledge of these cross-agency requirements. Information for families on the similarities and differences between these transition agencies. And then a directory of contacts for schools, service providers, and offices. So those were the top four. So the next slide, this is my final slide. It's just I wanted you to be aware of our activities and our timelines, so that you can know that I'm going to be reaching out to Mary when we do have some materials for feedback to see if people want to give input on Go.
I'm sure these guys live up. They're either been there or in education or have kids.
Yeah.
Or yeah.
So thank you very much for your time. I have my cards here. If you want to take one, again, happy to talk one-on-one with people outside of tonight if people have input or questions for me. So thank you.
Thank you.
Questions from the board? Any questions from the audience?
When is the proposed rollout for the new funding?
Right now, the proposal includes the coming school year.
Okay, so starting July 1, 2019.
Yes, whether that happens that quickly, but you know, part of it was districts are not going to be able to use levy funds for special education, and so there was urgency in doing this. So it may very well go through for this next school year.
Great.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
Perfect. Well, next on the agenda is Rosewood Community Living and Person-Centered Planning with Ron Bryan with DDA.
Yes, that's me.
Thank you, Ron. Welcome.
Thank you, Mary and Trish, invited me to come down and share some information with the group. So I didn't put together a PowerPoint, but I have an invite here to our conference, the Community Summit, later this summer.
And any of the board members, if it's something you want to go through, let me know. We provide that for you. And scholarships to others.
You know, it's really difficult now to go for people that are working because that's going to be
That's been a struggle with trying to find a place in the calendar to put that community summit since we started it. Okay, a couple of things I wanted to share with you guys today. First one, let's talk about Roads to Community Living. Roads to Community Living is the name of a federal program called Money Follows the Person. And the program is a program that provides specialized services and supports to assist people who live in qualified institutional or facility-based settings to transition to community-based settings. So we help folks move, for example, from the RHCs to supported living in the community. Some of the services that we provide, when a person enrolls in the program, even while they're still residing in a facility, we can begin providing kind of preparatory services like person-centered planning. We can connect individuals with supported employment programs and start building some things that will support a transition to the community. And then after a person transitions from a facility to the community, we can provide services like supported living, environmental modifications, specialized equipment, startup costs. So if a person is moving into their own apartment or home and they need pots and pans and bed linens, we can actually provide some money to purchase those kinds of things. So a lot of excellent services and supports to help that be a successful transition into the community. After 365 days, then the person transitions out to the community and our program supports them for 365 days, at which point they would be transitioned into one of our HCBS or long-term service and supports programs, such as the CORE waiver or Medicaid personal care, for example. Our current RCL grant ended at midnight on December 31st, and we've been waiting and waiting and waiting for word about an extension or a renewal. And that's still in the works. What it means right now, for the time being though, is transitions that happen January 1st of 2019 and later, individuals who are transitioning out, we're still continuing to support individuals to transition, just the source of funds will change over to our HCBS waivers. The biggest impact is that in the RCL program, DDA, we get a 75% federal match, and so it really stretches our state dollars farther. With the other HCBS waiver programs, we get a 50% match from the federal government to support folks. So we're hoping that we get some word about an extension or a renewal. There is folks, I want to mention, I said, you know, January 1st, transitions happen on a traditional waiver, but if an individual had previously transitioned into the community on roads to community living, and for whatever reason, they've gone back to a facility-based setting, if they exit during this year, we can resume the RCL participation that they had previously engaged in. So that's one caveat to that.
So Ron,
yeah.
If that occurs, do they pick up where they were at?
Yes, exactly right. Yeah. That's why we say 365 days and not 1 year. Okay. Because if a person transitions to the community and then for whatever reason, it could be housing falls through, there's medical concerns, there's behavioral support concerns, and the person has to go back to a facility-based setting for a period of time, those 365 days pause, and then when they transition back out, we can resume. Okay. So that's a good point. So during 2019, we do have continued access to what we call reinvestment project money, which is a grant that comes along with the Money Follows the Person program, which helps us to do things to expand the capacity of communities to support individuals. So we've used that money. We did some, four counties participated in a mini grant around employment for people who have had a hard time accessing employment. We looked at some creative, innovative ways to increase capacity for folks like that. The community summit that I'm gonna talk about is sponsored in part with some seed money from the reinvestment budget. And that budget will expire on June 30th of this year. And individuals who transitioned to the community prior to December 31st, we will continue to have funding for them in the community and transitional assistance funds, technical assistance funds, which we can use on a case-by-case basis. And we use those, for example, somebody needs specialized equipment that's above and beyond what the Medicaid coupon pays for. We can pay for that, for example, technical assistance. And we have that through the end of December of this year. Legislative updates, like I said, we've been waiting for an extension or a renewal of the program, and there has been in Washington, D.C., a lot of support for the program, and there's been legislation drafted. The House approved a three-month extension, but the Senate attached their version of the extension bill to the continuing resolution, and of course, we all know where the continuing resolution is right now. It's stuck in the shutdown. The bill that's presently tied up in Washington, D.C., due to, the border wall funding, and here we are 3 weeks into that. The negotiations are ongoing, so even when the shutdown ends and they resume business, there's the language is still fluid and stuff. So even though it's been voted on and it has a lot of legislative support, we still have to make sure that the language stays in whatever legislation goes on to be funded. So we're confident, though, that we'll get an extension. There's also a possibility that we'll get a brand new grant, and then states could opt to reapply for that grant. And we'll see what happens with that, but we're hopeful for that. In the meantime, we'll continue administering kind of the run out of the clock on our current grant. The other thing that I want to talk about, any questions before I go on about roads to community living? I know that was just the kind of the highest, fastest level review of it. Yes.
I'm just curious how many people have requested it that are in the going out into the community.
That's a good point. I should have brought those statistics with me. We've supported, I believe 130 people have transitioned out. And there was an appropriation from the state legislature last year. We had 47 people that we had who had enrolled in Roads to Community Living who we hadn't had good traction on transitioning into the community. And they were continuing to be at the RHC, sometimes for the period of 2 or 3 years. They expressed an interest, and here it is a couple of years later. And so the state legislature did appropriate funding for 47 individuals to move into state-operated living alternatives. So to move into DD-operated supported living programs.
Which we don't have down here, Ron.
That's right, yeah.
Might be something to consider just because it's hard to find staff and living wage and all
that's,
that.
And that's the same problems we have in SOLA, of course. You know, we're looking at the same labor pool to staff SOLAs, to staff the state-operated programs. And they're located Pierce, Kitsap, Seattle, Spokane, Yakima. So they are, you know, and they're not all over the state. But so that was state funds that are apart from the RCL. Now, of course, if we transition those folks out on RCL, we were able to capitalize on that higher match rate, but that's work that's been done. And then, of course, with recent survey outcomes at Rainier School, there's also a push to create capacity for more folks. A lot of those folks need a nursing level of care, and they opted to go to Ferncrest RHC or to Lakeland RHC, where nursing services are provided. And there's others that we're working also on supported living, be that with a private nonprofit provider or with state-operated supported living.
What are they going to do with Rainier?
Rainier will continue operating, and the work will be towards, you know, getting it in line with compliance with the regulatory oversight that we've been cited with recently. And it's a matter of legislation. As long as it's still funded and it's still operating, our goal is to operate it with an eye for the safety and the health of the individuals who live there, and also making sure that they have access to the person-centered services to the community that we value for everybody who receives state services.
We met with a legislator this week. Do you want to tell him, or should I tell him? I don't understand. He thought you should turn Western State Hospital into a McMinimans, so it's the McMinimans brothers, and then move the forensic unit over to Rainier.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that was, that rumor's been out there for a long time, that the state plans on moving people from Western State down to Buckley to Rainier. If there's been discussions about that, it's outside my purview.
Okay, well, I thought McMinimans wasn't a half bad idea.
It is kind of a McMinimans looking property up there, so.
They made good improvements.
Yeah.
So what are you laughing at?
Any other questions about Rhodes?
I was just wondering about the family liaisons. They're funded through Rhodes, correct?
You talk about the family leaders?
Yes.
They we fund them through Rhodes.
Okay,
yeah,
just wanted
that's
to
a
double check.
Project. Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah. So we fund them actually with technical assistance, individual case by case.
Okay.
Or reinvestment, depending what nature of the activity is they're doing. But yes, through those funds. Okay, person-centered planning. So I know a number of folks in the room have attended some of the person-centered planning symposiums that we've hosted around the state. We've done those 4 years running now. First 2 years were up in Bainbridge, and then 2017 we hosted three of them around the state. One of them, which was right here in Vancouver, we had a person-centered planning symposium. And the purpose of those symposia were to bring together self-advocates, person-centered planning facilitators, families, allied advocates, services providing agencies, state, county, school district, other stakeholders who are interested in expanding the practices of person-centered planning in the state, to talk about kind of the state of things with person-centered planning, to get everybody on the same page, talk about ways to integrate person-centered planning across systems. One of the themes that has emerged from the symposiums, these questions come up each time, and that is, what constitutes a quality person-centered plan, and who is a qualified facilitator for person-centered planning? And people asked me, I've been to all the symposiums, what does the state require? Well, that's a good question. What do you guys require? And so we had this conversation at headquarters. Since we can use some of our waiver funds to pay for person-centered planning, who is a qualified facilitator for person-centered planning? So it's kind of an unanswered question. And this work that we're doing, go ahead.
We know.
Yeah, exactly right. The answer exists in the community.
And you have to go through some training.
That's right. Yeah. You have to go through some training. So those are the big questions, though. Okay. What does it look like? Of course, there's different approaches to doing person-centered planning. John O'Brien published the MAPS and the PATH processes for person-centered planning. Michael Small with his essential lifestyle planning. There's a variety of ways of doing person-centered planning. On each of those, I should say, has an expectation about who is qualified to be a facilitator, and has an expectation about what a quality person-centered plan looks like. But there isn't an accreditation board across all of them, so it introduces a level of complexity, especially a bureaucrat looking to conduct a contract. Well, which program do you come from, and are you qualified in that program, and how do I manage that if you come from this other program? So this is one of the themes that we're looking at. So even though there isn't an accrediting body or an agency that says this is a qualification, that there's no diploma that's standard across the field of thought of around person-centered planning, but each entity has its idea of what needs to be in a quality plan, and each entity has an idea of what are the skills and the training and the characteristics of a qualified facilitator. So we're conducting some conversations right now to see if we can come up with language that's inclusive enough that includes all of the different ways, because at their heart, all of them have the same objective, that the individual whose plan it is, their voice needs to be present and leading the person-centered planning meeting. It needs to talk about their strengths and their abilities and their desires and their goals. It needs to address any barriers or obstacles to accessing those goals. And it needs to come up with some action steps to work towards those goals. So that's something in common to all of the person-centered plans. When a facilitator should be somebody who has experience working with people who have intellectual and developmental disabilities. They should understand systems, and they should understand communities, and they should be interested in promoting self-advocacy and promoting people having a voice in the community. And they should have attended training through whatever system. They should be mentored by another professional. So we're gathering information right now about what those things look like. And our goal is to hopefully come up with maybe a bulleted list. These are the qualifications that person-centered planning facilitators should have. And these bullet points are, these are the essential components of a quality person-centered plan. And then we can use that for answering questions across systems and for talking about, if we're talking about PATH, person-centered planning, we're talking about essential lifestyles. We can look at a plan, however it was derived, and see that it has these mutually agreed upon essential characteristics. So that's the work that's happening right now. The work's happening with some of the person-centered planning cohorts around the state and with a subset of folks who've been involved in leading these symposiums. We're gonna put together the information. It all exists out there. There's been so much talk about this for years. And so we're kind of raking it all in, and we're gonna distill it into a draft document to share with a larger group and hopefully come up with these agreed upon essential characteristics of a quality plan and a facilitator. So we've got a conference call coming up on January 28th with a group that's composed of people who've attended the symposia. And then on June 11th, we're going to have an in-person meeting in conjunction with the Community Summit. So before I talk about the Community Summit, is there any questions about person-centered planning?
Is Trish part of that?
Trish is on that call, yes. She's in that group.
Because Susan is a mentor. We embedded it in education.
Uh-huh.
So Trish, or Susan is a mentor. What do you call them? The A-team.
Yeah.
But there's got to be a better name.
We've done significant training down here with educators in the local school district facilitating and helping to develop person-centered plans for years. We work with Kara
Sy
and
Devin McLean.
Yeah, great. So Devin McLean is working with me on this.
Right.
Yeah.
And then Meredith Alfred with it.
So if anybody's interested in participating in that conference call and the ongoing work that we're doing, you can shoot me an email. My contact information is on the bottom of this invite here, this save the date announcement.
And
I'll be glad to add you to that.
January what?
January 28th.
At what time?
9 o'clock in the morning.
That's right when school starts.
That's right when school starts.
First period. Yes.
Susan, okay. Can I ask Susan a question for you? Uh-huh. As part of your training, when you've been training educators, have you created any kind of resource that's a side-by-side between, say, a transition plan and a person-centered plan to see what would be required of both and what might be best practice?
We put a lot of times we will try to do the person-centered plan prior to like an IEP and then include some of that, the information that was gathered in the present levels on the IEP.
Yeah.
I am middle school, and so we have another teacher down here, a colleague that's in a neighboring school district that it does the transition program with GATE here in Vancouver.
And that's what we do at the state with DDA, providing services to the public. If an individual has a person-centered plan, we like that person-centered plan to be a part of the service planning that we do. If they don't have a person-centered plan, we like to begin the assessment with some person-centered work, some basic discovery into a person's goals and their interests. And we keep that at the forefront then as we conduct an assessment and we start thinking about paid services, how can we connect our paid services to the individual in such a way that it helps them pursue their goals, which probably aren't related to receiving a paid service. They're related to quality of life. So how can we use the eligibility services that we have to help a person access their community, to be safe in a relationship, to find employment that will help them move out on their own and have disposable income. So we that's what we use here. So
we have had a, in another school district that isn't that people here, I think, but for years where there was a seven-year-old that had a person-centered plan. I assume the family must have asked for it, or the child may have been complex.
I did one for a second grader and one second grader.
Yeah. And that was also
a couple years ago.
With you.
But different. He's not here, not a teacher. He's at CHS.
There was quite a bit of discussion about that, the October symposium, which was in Linwood. A lot of discussion about person-centered planning for younger people, and that it's something that can start as early as grade school and can then be used to inform education and home life and community life. Instead of waiting until a person's in the community, we can have goals and be working towards a brighter future from school age.
Are the people in Open Doors, are there any trained planners?
I'm sure there are. I'm not sure. That Ginger Kwan's organization, I know that they're on the invite list.
We have kind of a connection with them. Uh-huh. It's kind of weird that I wrote a letter of support for their first grant, and now they're always offered to do stuff with uh-huh. us. But, so I always ask about that.
So, Ron, how often... you were saying if a person hadn't had a person-centered plan, but say they've had many throughout their life, uh-huh. right? Because we are blessed enough to live in Clark County and have amazing facilitators down here. So, but say they're adults and it's been 10 years, 15 mm-hmm. years. How often can we update the person-centered plan through the DBA services to help drive additional?
This is another really complex question, mm-hmm. and that is, how do we help people access a person-centered plan? If people have a person-centered plan, how do we help them update that? And facilitators are people who are looking to do this work as work, and so they can be paid. And not everybody has access to a program that funds it. And so that's one of the discussions we've been having. How do we increase capacity in that way? Other people, for example, on the individual and family services waiver, they have a budget that's very self-directed how they use it, and they can use it for purposes.
So it's the aggregate dollars.
But it might buy up, all of their aggregate dollars for the year. Yeah. And we're looking at how do we include it in other waivers.
If they're in county services, they need to call.
And counties also.
Well. And if we get one done outside of DDA, can we use it to then drive our DDA services?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. If you say this is your person-centered plan and it's your goals, bring that to your assessment. Yeah. Okay. The last thing I wanted to mention is the Community Summit. And I know some folks in the room have attended the Community Summit before. It's coming up in June. This year, the theme is Enriching Lives. So we want to look at what are those things that make my life enjoyable, that bring me pleasure, that bring me the quality of life that I want. And so that's the theme that we're looking at this year. Again, it'll be in Wenatchee at the Convention Center. We were talking about earlier today about Intelligent Lives, and we're also working towards screening that film, Intelligent Lives, at the Community Summit. And we've had conversations with Micah Fialka Feldman, who is one of the students featured in the film, and his mother Janice. And we've been working with them to have them come and do a couple of sessions, present information at the summit, and also be present for a screening of the film.
So we just want to do a practice down here.
That
you
would
go. Oh, there you go. I mean, you need a dry run, and we can just do it.
We could just do it down here. That's right. Steal my thunder. I can't speak for. I don't. We're working on our own contract with them.
Who's working on it?
The steering committee for the Community Summit.
Okay. who might that be?
That would be me, and that would be Wise, and I have about 18, 20 people involved.
Okay, I'd be there.
I have self-advocates, parent coalition, supported living and supported employment providers.
Not me.
I'm excited about that, about having the film there at the community summit. Registration will begin in March. The website's up right now, but it basically just says, keep your eye here for information. And there's also a Facebook page called The Community Summit, which is a good place to find information. So if you haven't been to that, you go to it. The registration opens, you apply through your county, and the counties do some stipends and some scholarships. Everybody who applies for a stipend or a scholarship that the counties can't support, those are forwarded to me, and I also have a budget to sponsor some stipends and scholarships. So we want everybody to come. Last year we had a record number of attendees. We had over 1,000 people register and close to 1,000. There's some attrition, of course, between registrations and who actually shows up. But it was our biggest crowd ever. And I'm hoping to, of course, match that for this year. So I hope to see you guys at the Community Summit. Again, I'm Ron Bryan. I put my contact information on the back of this Save the Date flyer. And I'd love to hear from you about person-centered planning, RCL, Community Summit, or any DD topic. Yes?
I have a question about submitting proposals for the workshop to the summit. I couldn't get a fillable form, so I downloaded, printed it, hand-wrote it, and then took a picture and sent it to you.
I never received it.
Did you?
Okay. Yes.
I was like, there's got to be a better way.
Was that just today?
Yeah, or yesterday.
Yesterday, yeah.
I was like, really? I can't. There should be a fillable form.
My intent was it was fillable. So
was
it? Yeah.
Was it? And I didn't get it fillable? Or
I don't know. Who knows? Yeah.
So the link was just like, okay.
I've asked those to come back by January 11th, but okay. You in reality, we keep hearing ideas right up until the actual cutoff is when we send information to be printed in the booklet, then we can't make changes. But that's in March. So I want to have time to, you know, look at everything and make decisions. But
I was like, I wonder if it's readable.
It's readable. Okay. I have it. Yeah.
Good.
It was there.
Any questions from the board? Any more questions from the audience? Thank you, Ron.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity. This is no other counties have invited me to come talk to them, so I really appreciate the opportunity to partner with you guys.
Can you come back?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, our next agenda item is with Darla, and that's the legislative update, and all the happy. Well, one. I see one that's not there.
Well, there's a star, but it doesn't say a lot of that.
Right. So you all have copies of the governor's budget that came out prior to Christmas. As you can see, there are lots and lots of smiley faces on here. This budget was developed on the contingency that some new taxes will be passed or some new funding will be changed on a state level. Historically speaking, please, those of you who are government budget people, jump in if I misspeak. But historically speaking, when that is done, we get a book one and a book two budget. And this year we didn't get a book one and a book two budget, we just got the one budget. So
that's illegal.
So, but it looks really good if it all goes through. So we're hoping that it goes through because it looks really good like this.
Who's going to arrest the governor?
And we are recording. but it looks really good. So we were very pleased. You can see all the smiley faces. This is the best governor's budget I have seen in as long as I can remember. And so we're very hopeful. As Mary said, it is just the first step in the process. So we are going forward. I was very pleasantly surprised. And I can go, if you guys have questions on specific things, I can talk to you about them. But
the one that I see that isn't smiling, is kind of scratching his or her head. which is Fund Electronic Visit Verification.
So what that is when a IPP, individual provider goes into a family's home, whether that's for respite, and I'm not sure if respite's included, but respite, personal care, different things like that. Right now, if that provider is working for an agency, they're already doing electronic verification. They have to, with a phone, call in when they arrive to kind of almost like punch the time clock, so to speak, right? There is been a requirement put forth through CMS, right, to do that for all individual providers. And so there's been some question, how are we going to do that? Because as a parent provider, when am I exactly am I supposed to call in that I'm now working, right? Would that be at 1:30 at night when the electricity goes off and they're freaking out, and then 20 minutes later it comes back on and I click off? I mean, you know what I mean? So for parent providers, it doesn't make a lot of sense. There's been a lot of pushback on it, so there's been a lot of work that's being done on a federal level. So it's been pushed off in its implementation of when it will start. But it's still a requirement that it's being done, and we don't really have a good system in how we're going to do that. But the governor has put money toward it, and so that's why we're kind of going like, we're not sure about this. We're doing conference calls. I just scheduled one today. I think it's the 22nd, maybe. There's another call on it that's a statewide call, trying to figure out what is this going to look like. Originally, if we didn't get it done on time, well, there was going to be a large fine, but then the federal government pushed it back a little bit. So that's the head scratch.
Any comments from the board? Questions?
Well, I just think that since we have somebody from the state central office here, that when you got to watch, I know the residential services need additional funding because it's a crisis, but if you get the residential and the employment, if you don't pay attention to both, you'll have a new crisis.
Yes.
So there's always a dance that needs to be watched. Not that there's a crisis right now, but it's a watch so you don't go to them.
The other thing that housing is really first and foremost in my mind these days for lots of reasons, and the DDC has created a document that's going to get plastered all over the legislature, and it's all about housing and what needs to be done to stabilize housing. But when they talk about stabilizing housing for individuals with developmental disabilities, they're talking about individuals in residential programs, individuals in SOLAs, and individuals in RHCs. And I just like to point out, that's like 4,600 individuals out of 48,000, right? The majority of those individuals are living in other places. They're in home, they're in their own places, they're across the parking lot, they're across the street, right? Trying to find other, more appropriate methods of meeting their needs than our current residential system, which is really archaic. And so, I just get really concerned when I see stuff going to the legislature that's pushing on what we currently have. Yes, I know it's significantly underfunded and needs to be fixed, but we're still really not addressing, you know, those 900 a year that are coming out of school and needing
something different.
Yeah, because the residential programs we have set up now were really created for individuals really that didn't have the opportunity to go to school. Right? That's the residential model we have. And so now we have individuals that are going to school from, you know, 2 weeks through age 21, and they're coming out with a different expectation and a different focus in life. Sorry.
So, quick question. So, the third one, now funding for 51% of the high school transition students on the basic plus waiver. I've never seen it described like that.
Yeah, and usually they say a number. There's a certain number of the high school graduates that are already on the basic plus waiver.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And there's also a percentage of the individuals that graduate that choose to not go after employment services.
Okay.
And only those who are going after employment services typically are moved to the basic plus
waiver. Oh, got it. Okay. Okay.
So between those two things, that's how they came up with the 51%.
Okay, got it.
Almost 900.
Yeah, something happened with outreach. And I think sometimes that when we started doing birth to three in natural environments and in regular daycares, which is great and it's good for the kids and everything like that, but families became disconnected. And when families are disconnected, that's part of the dreaming that Mona always talks about. They don't bounce those dreams off each other anymore, and we gotta do something besides Facebook for them.
I'd like to morph it into what we're doing right now with touching base with some of our legislators. How many have we met with so far?
Well, we had 4 or 5 appointments, and then people are canceled. So I'm going to talk to Representative Harris tomorrow. Well, he's driving, but she said I could have this whole drive if I wanted. From Seattle. Which is way too much time. And then we have Linda Wilson on, and Representative Wiley on Friday. So it will be 4 or 5.
Was there still an appointment on Saturday?
There's one on Saturday.
Oh, yes. Do you want to come?
I can do that.
Okay, 1 o'clock when Trudy was fine. And I think where the town hall is.
The town hall's at the ESD.
So I think it's the Starbucks on Andreessen.
I would imagine.
By
yeah.
Winco there.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
At 1 o'clock. Okay. We've asked her to clarify down the street Starbucks, just because there are a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
So I'll send that out to you too, Susan?
I have a class.
Oh, okay. Then yeah. Just that'd be great to have you and Meredith. That's great. Okay.
But have we heard anything from them that can give us some insight other than the number to nod or smile?
No. We're also meeting with them right now, and I know that Senator Cleveland is still looking. She doesn't even have her LEM check, so
she has nobody to call right now.
Yeah, so they're, you know, session starts Monday morning.
Have any RSVP'd for the reception?
You know, Hattie, who works with me, is the one who's keeping track of that. I think she said she's got 4 that's RSVP'd from our local community. They only track our 5 districts.
The one that is kind of outstanding, that a lot of them know us, and they know what we say, because we say the same thing a lot of times.
We just package it different sometimes.
And it's good to chat. But Vicki Kraft did not respond. She's when everybody else has kind of responded, except Annette's person said, or somebody for Annette said, she's trying to pound through 40 emails of requests. But Vicki Kraft was a total unknown to me. She didn't come to the candidates night either. Mm-hmm. And so, and she's on Jayla.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I was a little, if those of you in the 17.
Oh, 17?
17. Yeah. I think, isn't she?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, she is.
Yeah, okay. And Larry Hoff, we don't know where to call him.
Yeah.
He has no phone number yet.
But we'll know what his email will be.
Oh,
so
yes,
we do now. Yeah.
So is it worthwhile to continue even though session starts on Monday? Does that in turn basically say, okay, that's our deadline, we wouldn't be able to get meeting?
Yeah, unless we go up. Which, if you all want to go up, then I will take you up.
Yeah, we can come up on Wednesday.
We can go up with Darby.
We're going to be leaving probably about 3
good
on
morning.
Wednesday.
No.
We don't need anything.
Oh, she's talking about for the reception.
For the reception on Wednesday afternoon.
But during the Wednesdays that they go up, anybody's head, I think, did he go up Wednesday?
Yeah.
Well, the transit update, just two things I wanted to share with you. One is we finalized an RFP to do what is called van grant. Some of our vehicles, surplus vans, and what I mean by van, it's not what you consider your normal vans. They're the Eldorado buses that you see C-Van using all the time. They are going to be available on a grant program to any private nonprofit as a means of maybe taking the useful lives of these diesel vehicles and giving them to another nonprofits. And so if you would like to know how to apply for that, just go on to ctran.com. And the RFPs are on there, and the only proviso with the Eldorado buses, and we're also going to have some conventional passenger vans as well, is that in order to drive the Eldorado buses, you have to have a Class C CDL. We were hoping that we could eliminate a row of seats and thus make it lower in capacity, but unfortunately the man or the woman, I don't know who it is preventing us from being creative in that regard. But we are going to have some of the vans from the van pool program that are also going to be, instead of auctioned off, they'll be given as a way to help spread the capacity throughout the county.
So, for the vans, because the Class C is a barrier, for the vans, is it going to be through the same grant application then?
What would be this?
You said the van pool.
Yes. Well, that's not 100% solidified, but yes, I think it probably will be, is that once we establish the process of the van grant program, and it has been established, that would be probably the mechanism for the other type of vehicles.
So I guess my question is, if you're interested in one of the smaller vans, mm-hmm. should we go ahead and apply now?
What I would suggest is wait until it's announced that those vehicles are, and they will be sometime this year, I think within the first or second quarter of 2019.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. You want a van?
As long as it meets the criteria of the RFP, which is basically, is it going to benefit the community? And I have some doubts.
Wait till my next presentation. Won't.
The other thing is the fact that C-Van, as we're providing connections for a lot of individuals that are going to employment, we're running into a problem where we can't predict with 100% certainty when we'll be at a destination. And so what has happened is that some of our customers, that they are to meet the job coach at 11 o'clock as an example, and we get them there at 10:30 or 10:45. The problem is that the job coach is not there. And so what we want to do is have myself and my supervisory team meet with some of the job coaches as a means of working with them so that we can eliminate that disconnect.
The directors have a meeting with Kristen and Chris.
Sure. You can just send me the time and the date and all that kind of stuff. And then finally, we are going to be starting a community van pool. It's called the Community Access Van. It's with our $5,310, where we're going to get a body-on-chassis vehicle that has a design limit of 10 to 12, thus eliminating the CDL requirement. that the Human Services Council will be coordinating with other nonprofits to provide a van pool. And it's almost like a check out the basketball at the rec program, and they could use it and help provide additional access outside of our service area boundaries and stuff like that. So some exciting things with transit, but it's always exciting.
Right? Always.
The days of boring the crap out. Anyway, housing project.
So, which is actually one reason why we're interested in our in a van. So we have started this year through the housing project a peer-to-peer training. And it's actually going really well. Our I call them young adults, which means they're probably under 55. but they are meeting every Thursday. And right now we're meeting in one location, but we really want to be able to get out in the community and do more stuff with them. And so working on different skills, people can come to one, they can come to many, dropping kinds of things. And it's been really successful, and the young adults that we've got coming is just really, they're excited. I really am very motivated to figure out how to make it more inclusive, while at the same time realizing that the skill sets that some of them are working on is at a really different level than the skill sets that other individuals would be working on. But they're really, they're learning from each other, they're each other's teachers. And so that's really what's working so well and is so exciting. We also have done, part of our housing project was the technology research and coming up with the technology stuff. And so we have a fairly good list now of technology information. And I really, one of the things as you guys were talking, I really want to do is go back now and connect with DDA to figure out, you know, under which programs can we access technology, under which, now that we have a better list of the types of technology that might help individuals live more independently.
Tom Farrow would like to sponsor some of the project.
Sounds like he's got a brother in his alley, that's right.
Okay.
We have information about that. I think the community summit last year
We did some.
Yeah.
And so this kind of went beyond what we did at the community summit to do some other stuff. But then from all of that, we have designed and are looking forward to putting on a housing conference, which will be held May 13th here in town. And the housing conference is going to have three different tracks. And we're hoping it will be a regional level conference. One track is actually going to be brick and mortar. County policies, different things like that, what's really affecting that brick and mortar type of housing issue. Another track's going to be the technology track, and then another track will be services, because the service provider issue is always a piece. And then what, really trying to look at what can we do creatively. King County had an amazing housing conference that they did this fall sometime. And so we actually have the ability to pull on what a lot of King County's done and then look nationally and grow from there as well. What else can we do and what do we need to look at to really figure out, it's not that our residential providers aren't great, because they really are, but as we look at inclusion in school and how inclusion really drives outcomes, right? Then to take somebody out of that inclusive setting that we're fighting so hard for them to get and put them in a residential segregated setting is not appropriate. And so how do we figure out what that next residential options look like? And so I'm really motivated for selfish reasons as well as professional reasons to figure out what that looks like as we move forward. And what does that look like when the parent is no longer here to help support those models? We've seen it be very successful in many scenarios where the parents there are providing all that extra fill and support, but we're all time limited, so how do we extend past ourselves? Anything else, Mary, that I missed? We are so grateful at peace to be able to have the opportunity to have this housing experience and housing grant. And to really, I mean, you know, it's been a year now that we really focused on it. We did I can't even remember what we called it. Faith did the little groups, and she met with everybody, and we came up with our big document of research. And then from there, honed it down to the three topics of the conference and the peer-to-peer trainings and the technology. And then from that, now going on to building the conference. So we're just very, very grateful and feel very blessed to have this opportunity to explore. So, you know, you have to have your housing set so employment can grow, and all of the baby work that we start with birth to three and all of that work, it just keeps building on itself, right? And I look around, and in our community right now, everything that's being built appears to be for senior population. And when you look forward, you know, 30 years, 35 years, we're not going to have the amount of senior population that we have now. So I think we will have a lot of affordable brick and mortar opportunities that are already built in the future. So what do we do in this in-between time right now?
But there is, and we have someone who is interested in developing some units. We don't want them segregated. You know, and a lot of the units being built in mental health are the whole complex is for behavioral health and has some supports in it, appropriately so. But it does not work for people with developmental disabilities. They do better with an integrated. Like Covington Commons, yeah. Where maybe it's a family who has a young child with a disability, and that family still qualifies to be in one of those set aside units.
That's a, you know, like for SOLA, where we're right now developing capacity to support people, and that looks like homes in the community. And it even becomes an issue when it's two houses side by side. It begins to look like it looks, it needs to be just out there, mixed with everybody else.
Exactly.
Yeah. You gotta watch. There's a lawsuit on residential in Minnesota. It hasn't settled yet. Four-person.
On integrated settings, or
the four-person grouped homes, yeah. And plaintiffs have a point, and the state isn't backing down. So I don't know where they're gonna go.
So the Housing Trust Fund projects were funded on December 9th. And one of the projects is here in Clark County, but I don't know what the project is.
We can call. Yeah, I mean, it's in our
department. And of course, there's been a lot of the SOLAs are going to be increased, but there's none set to be down here.
We have a goal for that.
We have a goal. Yes, we do. We have a strong goal for that to happen. So we're working on
that.
I love the technology.
Okay, there's one other thing that people need to know about. We are going to have, I think, an autism center with excellence in Clark County. And the University of Washington is finally driving south of Longview.
Okay.
That's really hard after this many years to realize that they finally can go south.
But still part of Washington.
Yeah, well, it's news to them, but they were, this morning on our call, they were committed to doing it. What I'm asking people to do, if you know of physicians, especially pediatricians and primary care docs that might want to come to a training, they're going to do a training on the 26th and 27th of April
in Vancouver.
Darla and I are responsible for figuring out the place. I think it's really important we have something in our community, because we can't get people who are poor over to OHSU, and it's a long way to Seattle.
What does the Center for Excellence, Autism Center for Excellence, other than the title, what does that mean?
It will increase our ability to be able to get diagnoses. And by getting diagnosing, we then can access services. So right now we have a backlog of up to 1 to 2 years for a family who's got a young child on the autism spectrum to get diagnosing. And our families have to either go to OSHU if they have the right insurance, or they have to go up to Tacoma or Seattle. So that doesn't work very well when you have a young child with autism. To be able to access the ABA services, if you've got Medicaid, if your insurance is through Medicaid, you have to have your diagnosis through a center of excellence to be able to access the ABA and some of those other therapeutic
totally
services.
Impacts people who are lower income.
Yeah, we're seeing an increase in schools doing like an educational type diagnosis just for school services, but that doesn't affect, that doesn't help with the private insurance and ABA that's outside of school.
And so it really is huge. And one of the things that if we can find, and we are dedicated to finding a location that's large enough so that we can bring in ABA therapists, SLPs, OTs, special
educators, and
to be able to come in and work in collaboration with the physicians and the psychiatrists who will be doing the diagnosing so that we can help educate on not only what is it like to get this diagnosis, but then what do we do after we give them the diagnosis? Where do we go from here? So that we really beef that up. As a community, Southwest Washington really has been behind.
And left out. Yeah. I would say left out, which is all the more reason we need to get Senator Friedman too. But I just thought that.
That's very exciting.
And that's going to happen this spring?
April 26,
27.
Is the Center of Excellence training. We'll see how big a place we get, and that will determine how broad the... I'm also having a conversation with the special ed directors, and Alan Fleck is helping he's helping call people together because our parking is really bad.
Anybody on the board have anything they want to add? Anything from the community that would like to be shared?
I might mention just very briefly that Amy Price, our field service administrator, has taken a position in at headquarters. We now have an acting field service administrator, FSA, who is Judy Miller, and many people know Judy Miller as a case resource manager and as a waiver specialist. So we're excited. We're sad about Amy leaving us, but we're excited to have Judy in her new position.
She didn't leave our housing project, though, so you know, you really don't leave her.
Anything else? If I don't hear any objection, I propose that we adjourn. Thank you.